Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. On the show today, we return to the classics in the form of an OTR episode from X-1.
X-1.
It is a creepy sci-fi tale called Dr. Grimshaw's Sanitarium.
Well, I think I know him.
We have two ghost stories from you guys, from podcast past, and a brand new edition of A Moment in Time from September 2nd, 1945. To start things off, we begin with yet another five-minute mystery.
Another five-minute mystery.
This five-minute mystery is brought to you by man's ingenuity. We have spent thousands of years learning the art of murder, only to have our efforts spoiled by the authorities. Is there such a thing as the perfect crime? Does ice melt? Let's find out.
Hello, Mr. Minton. How are you?
Well, hello, Joe.
You're going to take a nice Turkish bath in the steam room, Mr. Minton?
Yeah. Look at that fat, Joe.
All right, here's a towel. You like a massage after, maybe?
No, I haven't time. Say, is old man Wallace in there getting steam? I said I'd meet him.
Yeah, he must be plenty hot by now. There's five or six customers in there. Oh, I'll open the door for you, Mr. Minton.
Oh, thanks, Joe. Call me in 10 minutes.
Sure. Let me see. Mr. Turner said I should call him in 15 minutes. Mr. Wallace said that... What's the matter? Steam pipe broke, maybe? Somebody getting burnt? What's the matter in there? You got trouble? Who screamed?
Oh, old man Wallace has just been stabbed to death. He's been stabbed in the back.
Well, George, you find anything?
There's still a lot of steam in that room, Chief, but I searched it thoroughly. There's no knife anywhere. Ceiling, floor, walls...
And yet Wallace was stabbed. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And what's worse, the room was so thick with steam, no one saw the murderer do it. What about the men that were in there?
I searched them thoroughly, Chief. Nothing but this collection of towels.
Joe, did you see anyone go into that steam room with anything but a towel in his hand? You were standing right here at the door all the time.
No, sir, Chief. Just towels and maybe a toothbrush.
Toothbrush?
Yeah, toothbrush with a little black case. After the murder, Mr. Minton handed it to me as he came out of the steam room and told me to put it in his locker, but I didn't have time. Here it is, right here.
Let's see. Toothbrush, all right. Good solid plastic tube with a top to put it in. You couldn't stab a man. Wait a minute. This holder. George, quick. Get Minton in here.
Right.
I'm going to look in that steam room once more, but now I know what I'm looking for.
Mr. Minton, would you please get a robe on? The chief would like to see you in here a minute.
Well, I'm glad to talk to the chief any time, but I'm sure I've told him all I know about this thing.
Here's the chief now.
Oh, hello, Mr. Minton. Just a couple of questions more. Is this your toothbrush and case?
Why, Joe, I thought I told you...
It is yours, and you had it with you in that steam room when Wallace was killed. Minton, I'm arresting you for the murder of James Wallace.
Do you know how Minton killed James Wallace in the steam room of a Turkish bath? The chief will explain his deductions in just a moment. In the meantime...
Okay, for sure, we've been told too much and not enough. We've had proud moments and a shocking murder in a steam room. Honestly, when I heard this one, I was stumped. But we do have one clue. The toothbrush case. How was it done? Do you know?
And here's the chief to tell you how James Wallace was killed.
The method used was most unusual. When we think of stabbing, we think of knives. But no ordinary knife killed James Wallace. It was a disappearing knife.
Ah, how could a knife disappear, Chief? It's impossible.
Not if the knife were made of dry ice. Minton's toothbrush holder was a plastic mold in the shape of a dagger. In it, he carried into that steam room a dagger made of dry ice, withdrew it from the mold at the proper moment, and stabbed Wallace. He counted on it dissolving in the steam before it was discovered. I found a piece of it giving off its own form of steam in one corner of the steam room. Minton killed Wallace, and almost got away with a perfect crime if the murder weapon had disappeared.
Actually, this one's pretty clever. We didn't need to know why Midrin wanted to kill Old Man Wallace, but rather how was what we needed. I will guess that Midrin was a business partner, or perhaps he owed Wallace money. Either way, this 5-Minute Mystery was brought to you by man's ingenuity, such as it is. I have to say that I received this email sent in by Darren McLeod from Ripley, Maine. Like I said last week, I just read them, good or bad. Darren writes, "Ron, please read this review on the show. I want to be heard. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I generally listen to it for a while. Get bored with it, they pile up, and then I delete them. I started listening to you a few years ago, and I've yet to let them pile up or get bored. I won't say I love everything you do, but that is what makes you so different from anyone out there. You never know for sure what's going to happen on the show. Last week, you read some negative comments. Who does that? I would say someone who sees the value in presenting all sides. By the way, I didn't agree with anything said, and I hope you continue doing what you do. Darren from Ripley." Well, Darren, thank you for that. I do like your thoughts on presenting all sides, and I try to take it a bit further and present many styles of stories and topics. I think that's why I never get bored doing the show. Thank you again, Darren. An update on the UFO podcast. A lot of you have been asking when that show will air. I have all the stories I need now, but I haven't been able to confirm a UFO expert. In fact, none of the first-liners even responded to my emails. I still have hope, and I have another idea about a co-host for the show. I'm now thinking about a representative from MUFON. We had Phil Leach join us on episode 295, The MUFON Story. He was very good and is a field investigator for the Mutual UFO Network. Jose Munoz, who shared a story with us in episode number 375, An Encounter While Biking, sent in this email. "During our email thread, you mentioned something that struck a chord, that you script your show. That never occurred to me, and it certainly should have. Duh. You do it so well, it seems that you just pick up the mic and begin talking. I thought it might be interesting if you took 15 minutes just describing to us listeners how you go about putting together a show. I know I'd find it interesting. Just a thought. Jose from California." Well, Jose, I thought about this, and I'm not sure it'll take 15 minutes, but I am scripting it right now. Be looking for it soon in an upcoming episode, and thank you for the suggestion. We have a brand new place to listen to Ron's amazing stories. This week, the show has been added to Radio Public. They help podcasters build their business and listeners discover great stories. You can download their app on Google Play or on the iTunes App Store. Thank you, Radio Public. And now, this message from Gladys Goodies.
"I'm Gladdy, the dachshund, the face of Gladys Goodies. Are you worried about your pet's health? My parents were too, especially since I developed pancreatitis. They couldn't find any treats I could eat, so they made some. Our natural treats are healthy for all dogs, with and without health issues. We have lots of delicious flavors like chicken, turkey, salmon, sweet potato, beef, and more. With our homemade treats, you won't worry about the contents because they have no chemicals, fillers, or bad ingredients. Go to GladysGoodies.com now to get your fur friend a bag and pick them up some swag while you're there. You'll be glad you did. Remember, we have the treats and swag to make their tails wag. Again, that's GladysGoodies.com. Again, that's GladysGoodies.com.
Thank you, Gladdy, and don't forget to use our very own promo code, RONS, to get your 20% discount. That is RONS. And now, here are your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
Well, this time we have an Easter edition of stories. I'll bet you think that they're all going to have an Easter theme, right? No. You see, I'm a bit behind on reading your emails and prepping stories. My mom has been sick, I had to have dental surgery, and, well, Easter happened. So, this time we're going to do a best of your stories. How about that? Here are two tales from Podcast Past. Our first story comes from episode 281, The Ghost of Berlin. Back when this one was on the show, we didn't have a These Are Your Stories segment yet, so it aired as a As Read By. I hope you like it.
As Read By. Amazing stories read by amazing people.
This time on As Read By, we have a story sent in by Shamir Dongsuk. I have to apologize if I misspoke your name. I tried to get the pronunciation, and that was the best I could come up with. Shamir lives in Ely, Nevada, and leads a ghost hunting group there. Here is his email sent in via the website. Hello, my name is Shamir, and I have a ghost tale for you. Many people have strange hobbies, and I guess you have to put me on the list. You see, me and my mates go to the many ghost towns of Nevada to hunt and find evidence. Most of the time, we come home tired and empty-handed. There was this one time we came home tired, scared, and with this true ghost story. The only evidence we have are some EBPs, bad pictures, and soiled garments. Fact. There are more ghost towns in Nevada than towns occupied by the living. By that count, it would take you years, if not a lifetime, to explore them all. One of them is the remote town of Berlin. Long before it was occupied by miners in the late 1800s, Berlin was a home to a sharp-toothed reptile who roamed the warm ocean waters that overran Nevada 225 million years ago. In 1897, during the post-dinosaur era, Berlin was founded as a small mining camp with a peak population of 300. The town consisted of a stagecoach station, a stamp mill, a school, and two blacksmith shops. Its downfall began in 1907 when the miners demanded higher wages and were refused. Today, 13 buildings still stand, and my group agree this place is haunted. We set up camp at a nearby campground. Our first night out, while adventurous and fun, was pretty quiet. The second night, we must have woke something up because it was anything but quiet. EVPs, strange noises, and even some missing equipment was the theme. It was that third and final night of hunting that had my team and I running for the hills. I was in what was left of a small home. The north wall was completely gone, and the roof was nothing more than a few crossbeams. I had a recorder, and my partner Barb was sweeping with an EMF detector. We both commented at the same time about a temperature drop. While recording changes, you say your name, the time of day, and then make your statement. That was so the person reviewing the tape can know that it was a team member and also record the information. We made the statements, and then a third voice, as clear as day, says,
"That happens here every night in the spring."
We both looked at each other, and I watched Barb
go white. I replied, "Oh, have you lived here long?" Complete silence. It was Barb who spoke next. She said, "My detector is dead." Again, I turned to my friend, and standing next to her was a complete, full-figured gal. She was in all white and was dressed in what best could be described as a nightgown of some sort. "Barb," I began, "you're not alone over there. I just..." She screamed and started to flail about like she was being attacked by wasps. "Get it off," she yelled. I ran over to her, and I noticed that the full-figured gal was running towards her as well. I happened to get a look at her face, and she looked as perplexed as I did. We arrived at Barb to find that a large tarantula was climbing up her leg. I knocked the thing off with my finger and then remembered the ghost. I looked around, and it was gone. Barb was still whining about the spider, but was calm enough to ask who it was that came to help. I told her, and, well, that was it for Barb. She handed me her detector and went back to camp. I stayed in that building for the next 3 hours and never had anything else happen. After we returned home and reviewed all the data, there was nothing recorded for that entire time. A real shame. We had one more event. Another group was in one of the blacksmith shops. When a team member asked, "Do you want us to leave?" the reply was, "Yes." We thought the reply so cool, we decided to accept the comment and ended the investigation. Wow, Shamir, that is an amazing story. Incredible. Did I understand right? Did the recordings you make all turn out erased, or just no evidence of the full-figured lady? Please let me know on that. Now, I had never heard of Ely, Nevada, so I just had to look it up. It was founded as a stagecoach station along the Pony Express and Central Overland Route. Ely had a mining boom with the discovery of copper in 1906. Most of the stations connecting the first transcontinental railroad to these mines have long been removed. However, the railroad to Ely is preserved as a heritage railway by the Nevada Northern Railway. It is known as the Ghost Train of Old Ely. As of the 2010 census, the population of Ely was 4,255. To Shamir, I say, thank you for your story. That is a special one. By the way, I did hear back on this, and the EVPs survived, but none of the video. This next story comes from episode 321, The King of Bone and Ashes. This one was also before we had a dedicated segment. I had author J.D. Horn on to talk about his latest book. The story took place in New Orleans, and that is, coincidentally, where this story, Grandpa Theodule, took place.
I was read by Amazing Stories, read by amazing people.
This time on As Read By, we have a coincidence that is truly amazing. A listener tale that just happens to be from New Orleans, the home of J.D. Horn's newest series of books. There's no way I could have planned this, even if I'd tried. I received this email from Aaron Michaels a few weeks ago. "Hello, Ron. I took your advice and I'm contacting you about my story. I was born, raised, and bleed Bayou blood. I'm a collector of stories, much like yourself, and when I was a young girl, I remember sitting in the kitchen of my Grams and listening to her telling me all manner of stories. I would like to share some of these with you. Are you interested, Aaron? Well, I couldn't reply fast enough, and I got my first story from Aaron this past week. Here is her story from the amazing city of New Orleans. I edited this one gently with Aaron's permission. It was told to her by her grandmother, and it goes something like this. Each spring, the family gets together for the biggest Creole shrimp feed that you can possibly imagine. People would come from all around town to join in the fun and games of the day. We had all manner of foods, with shrimp as the main course. And, of course, you can't have shrimp without crawdads, and they were aplenty as well. In the spring of 1962, great-grandpa Theodule had just passed away. He loved the yearly event, and on his deathbed he swore that he would attend. Well, he sure came through on this promise in the most interesting and spooky way. Everyone that was there swears to this day that all this really happened. Families were arriving and setting up their stretches. Each family had their own table, and it was more of a meeting spot than for eating. The idea here is that you celebrate the family and its history. Any members lost that year would have a place set for them at the table. At our family's table, Theodore's picture was set and an empty plate placed before it. The party began with music ranging from jazz to Creole classics. It is a mix of musical styles originated with the influences of Cajun, African, and Spanish music. It's very hard to describe, but fun and historic to listen to. Great-grandpa Theodule was a bit of a Creole musician himself, and it was here that he first made his presence known. All who were at the table swear that his picture floated up and began to sway with the beat of his favorite tune. No strings, levers, or other tricks could be found, and when the music stopped, the picture dropped. It would repeat this every time one of great-grandpa's favorite tunes were played. No one at the party was surprised by this, and it wasn't even considered abnormal. Next came the feed, and Grandpa Theodule would not miss this. While the people filled their plates and told stories around the boiling pots of shrimp and crawfish, somehow Theodule's plate was filled with fine Creole fare. It was steaming hot and ready to eat. The family just left the plate and knew that Grandpa had made the party and was enjoying the day. Many say that ghosts had their own party, and who am I to say it's not true? The yearly event continues on today, and as I write this, we're preparing for it. I have no doubt that Great-Grandpa Theodule will have his place in line. Aaron Michaels, New Orleans, Louisiana. Wow, what a timely story, and amazing to boot. I want to thank Aaron for sharing it, and to Theodule, I say, have an amazing time there this spring. To the listeners, I say, if you want to share your story like Aaron did, it's very simple. Head to ronsamazingstories.com, click on the contact tab, and start typing. That's all there is to it, and then your story could end up on Ron's Amazing Stories. Do it today, won't you? Well, I hope you enjoyed these stories from the past. They are two of my favorites. Sometime I will do an all-time favorite show, but not today. We have had some truly amazing stories in our past. This time, our story comes from the classic old-time radio series, X-1. It aired on NBC from 1955 until 1958, and a total of 124 episodes were made. there was a revival of the series in 1973 when a group of NBC executives attempted to bring back the radio drama. It lasted until 1975. Our story is a crossover consisting of horror, crime drama, and science fiction. This one is well acted and written, which was the norm of all of the X-1 productions. It is titled Dr. Crimshaw's Sanitarium, and this version aired on July 14th, 1955.
Countdown for blast-off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on 1,000 maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street & Smith, publishers of Astounding Science Fiction, presents
X-1.
Tonight's story, Dr. Grimshaw's Sanitarium. What you will hear in the next half hour represents either a magnificent hoax or the true explanation of the famous Grimshaw Sanitarium scandal which made the headlines back in 1947. The manuscript upon which this account is based was removed by the New York State Police from a fountain pen cover found in the doorway to Dr. Grimshaw's study. We offer this manuscript as evidence only. Whether it is authentic or not, you must judge for yourselves.
My name is John Dougherty. I'm a graduate of Hamilton College, class of 34, a member of Theta Alpha. I'm one of those fools who wanted some excitement in life, so instead of going into my father's shoe business, I became a private detective. These are facts. You can check them if you like. The rest of what I write here is so fantastic that I don't expect it to be believed. If anyone should find this manuscript and read it, all I ask is that you notify Miss Millicent Armbruster of 299 Wallace Avenue, Buffalo, that Johnny Dougherty is dead. On the evening of July 1st, Miss Armbruster and I were driving to a wedding. Not our own, although I wish it had been. It was Sunday, and in order to avoid traffic, I took the Old Mill Road, a single-lane dirt affair that runs past the Gowanda Cemetery.
Johnny, aren't you going too fast?
Not for this road. There's nothing around except some tombstones and...
Johnny, the gate to the cemetery.
Well, what about it?
That hearse, look out! Look out!
We skidded for about 20 feet and slammed into the back of the hearse. The two rear doors buckled and snapped open. It was a freak. A huge oak coffin with brass handles tipped up and began slowly to slide back toward us.
Oh, how horrible.
You stay right here, baby. You okay, Mac?
You don't pay much attention to speed limits, do you, Jack?
Now, look, let's not get hung up on who was right and who was wrong. I was going too fast and you were traveling without lights after dark.
Let's see your driver's license.
Right here.
Private eye, eh?
Now, if you don't mind, who does this joy wagon belong to?
Gowanda Funeral Service. It's being rented to Grimshaw.
Who?
Grimshaw from the private sanitarium.
Mind if I ask what you were doing after dark coming out of a cemetery with a wooden kimono?
We're moving one of Grimshaw's patients to a new grave.
They always travel like this?
Look, Hawkshaw, how about skipping the third degree and giving me a hand getting this box back in the wagon?
A pleasure. Better screw on that cover again. It's going to slide off.
Let's get it in the hearse first.
Okay, Junior. You get on that end.
Okay. You ready?
Yeah, lift.
Just slide it.
Oh, brother, who's in there, King Kong?
Look out for the cover.
I told you that would happen. It's What's the guy's name, Junior?
Oh, why don't you ask him, Sherlock Holmes?
A real wise guy, huh? I've got half a mind to report this accident.
Yeah, well, go ahead. See where it gets you. Now, if you'll pardon me, I'll deliver the body.
Everything all right, Johnny?
I thought so until a few seconds ago. Listen, Millie, can you sit here in the car for another 5 minutes?
Where are you going?
For a stroll through the cemetery.
Oh, Johnny, stop making jokes.
When we lifted that coffin back on the meat wagon, I got a good look inside it.
Ew.
Yeah, exactly how I felt. I figured we'd knock the stuffing out of the corpse, only I didn't expect the stuffing to be sand.
What?
Yes. That wasn't a body, that was a dummy stuffed with sand, a dummy with a wax face.
Johnny!
Which brings up an interesting question. Who's supposed to be in that box, and, just where is the dead man spending his time? Sometimes in my business, when things drop off, you have to go out and, dig up new clients. My next case was a gentleman named Harlan Ward Sr., a wealthy automobile manufacturer. I'd gotten his name off his son's tombstone.
Are you trying to tell me, Dorothy, that my son Harlan was never buried at Gowanus Cemetery?
Exactly, Mr. Ward.
But why?
Maybe if you'll tell me the circumstances surrounding your son's death, I can help answer that.
My son was a rather impetuous young man. Tall, good-looking. After his graduation from Princeton, he began drinking quite heavily. After he got into a couple of scrapes, we sent him to Dr. Grimshaw's sanitarium in the hopes that he could be cured. While my wife and I were in Europe, we received word that he died, buried at Gowanus in our absence. Last week, my wife and I decided to have his body removed to the family vault here at Short Hills.
How'd your son die?
Suicide.
You never saw the body?
No. We couldn't get back from Europe in time. Now you tell me that his coffin contains a dummy. How do I know this whole thing isn't a plan to fleece me?
You don't. But you're a rich man, Mr. Ward, and you're perfectly willing to take a chance that I'm on the level and that your son may still be alive.
You sound very sure of yourself, Mr. Dorothy.
My fee is a $2,000 retainer plus expenses.
What sort of expenses?
However much it costs to take the cure at Dr. Grimshaw's sanitarium. Dr. Grimshaw's sanitarium was just outside Gowanda. Most of the cases were nervous breakdowns and alcoholics. I committed myself as a dipso, and just to make it convincing, I stopped at 5 or 6 bars on the way over. I was interviewed by Grimshaw himself, a small man with a fringe of white hair.
You understand, Mr. Dorothy.
That's not my real name, of course, social reasons.
We understand. Our paid clientele is very select and our rates are very high.
You'll be paid in cash and in advance, Dr. Grimshaw. How long does a cure usually take?
That, of course, depends on the degree of alcoholism. This is my assistant, Dr. Boynar.
How do you do?
How do you do?
We are accepting Mr. Dorothy as a patient. Better place him in the ward with Mr. Kay and Mr. Cakey. Mr. Kay is a long-term patient, Mr. Dorothy, a highly intelligent man, formerly a professor of plant pathology. Mr. Cakey suffers mild delusions. I think you'll find him rather amusing.
After about 3 days, my roommates Arthur Kay and Crakey got used to me, and we even began to play three-handed bridge. Kay was a chronic dope addict, an intelligent, sensitive man. Crakey was nothing but a clown. He kept a big black cat named the Professor, which he talked to as if it were human.
And so I said to her, "My dear Countess, if you don't like the company of my cat, then you don't like me." She looked at me as if I were insane. But of course the joke was on her because I was. Hey, Professor? The Professor is very sociable. Excellent company.
Except when he kills birds and deposits them in your bed. He's nothing but a feline murderer as far as I'm concerned.
See? You have insulted him, Mr. K.
Come here, Professor. Let's make friends. How about giving me your paw?
Oh! Scratched me, you black devil.
You insulted him. You hurt his feelings.
Well, just keep him away from me.
It will be a pleasure. I would advise you not to insult him again. Good afternoon and evening.
Is he always as nuts as that?
Ever since I've been here.
What's his problem?
Manic depressive. And a little paranoid, too.
How long have you been here, Arthur?
I'm sure it's 2 years. I left for a while, but I couldn't stay away from the junk, so I committed myself again.
Did you happen to know a patient here named Harlan Ward?
Why do you ask that? Did you know him?
No, I met him socially a few times. I understand he died here.
So the newspapers said. I wouldn't know.
Suicide, wasn't it?
Was it?
You're being pretty careful, aren't you?
Mr. Doherty, what would you say if I were to tell you that I don't believe Harlan Ward is dead?
What makes you so certain?
He used to share this room with us. He slept in the same bed you now use.
I see.
He was an alcoholic, doing quite well, too, from what I could observe. We all expected him to go home soon. Then one evening he had a violent fight with Crakey. Crakey accused him of snooping or something. Later that night, Grimshaw and Voyner took him out.
Where?
Where they take all the special treatment cases. To the charity clinic. It's that small building on the other side of the stone wall. A few days later, we read about his death. Suicide, they said.
Just what makes you think he's still alive, Arthur?
This. About a month ago, I was in the garden next to the wall that separates us from the charity clinic. Suddenly, I thought I heard a sound, like a child whimpering. It stopped. And a moment later, this note came over the wall, wrapped around a stone.
What's it say?
Help me, for God's sake, Harlan Ward.
Arthur, how would you like to have some fun?
Like what?
Like sneaking out tonight and going over the wall to the charity ward? What do you say? It would break the monotony a little.
I suppose there's no real harm in it.
Of course not. I'd go alone, but I'll need help scaling the wall. Will you do it?
All right. I'll go with you.
Up. All clear. Give me your hand and I'll lift you. Be careful when you drop. Ready?
Go ahead. There's a charity building over there. The one with the lights in the basement window.
Come on. Let's crawl over. Maybe we can see something. Shh. Listen. Can you make out what he's saying?
No, I can barely hear. Good Lord.
What was that?
Probably some patient having the DTs.
Let's have a look. Easy, it wouldn't do to get caught now.
See anything?
It's some sort of laboratory. I can see Grimshaw and Voynin and something else. What? There's a child with its back toward me.
Now take it quietly. It will be easier. Please, no!
It will all be over soon. You won't remember anything. Voyna, give it to him.
No!
Shut him up, Voyna!
Good Lord. What was it? What did he do to that child?
Mother, that wasn't a child. It was a midget. The smallest midget I've ever seen.
What were they doing?
Trying to give it some sort of injection. When it resisted, Voyna knocked it out.
What do you suppose they were doing to it?
I don't know, Arthur. All I know is that when it fell, it had the face of Harlan Ward.
All the way back to our room, my brain was working like some frantic pinball machine. Only the score somehow wouldn't add up. The pieces were there, all right. A crazy old doctor, a brutal assistant, a private sanitarium, and a midget with a dead man's face. I thought that when I got back to our room, I'd have some time to think about it. I'd forgotten about our friend, the happiness boy, Count Crakey.
Oh, I caught you.
Fine, you've caught us. Now, how about crawling back into the woodwork like a good little count?
Where were you?
Mink hunting. Arthur and I like to go mink hunting at night.
You make fun of Count Crakey? I shall report you to Dr. Voyner.
You'd better not if you know what's good for you.
So, you threaten me. Me, Count Crakey. I shall scream for help. Help! Help!
Did you hurt him?
Just knocked him out.
What do we do now?
Put him to bed. Hope that when he wakes up in the morning, he's forgotten the whole thing.
And if he hasn't?
He's too crazy for them to take seriously anyway. Come on, let's get him back into bed. I went to sleep in my own room. And the next thing I felt was the sharp jab of the hypodermic needle in my left arm.
Hold it.
It'll be useless to struggle, Mr. Doherty. In a moment, your motor nerves will be completely paralyzed.
What's this about, Grimshaw?
I might ask the same of you. My good friend Count Crakey informs me you and Mr. K decided to do some snooping earlier tonight. He followed you and saw you climb the wall.
Crakey's insane.
Mr. Doherty, that is a matter of opinion.
Crakey, what is this?
Perhaps my assistant, Dr. Grimshaw, would be good enough to explain.
Assistant?
Yes. You see, I am the actual head of the Grimshaw Sanatorium.
Count Crakey feigns many delusions, Mr. Doherty. But in this case, he is telling the truth. Count Crakey is actually Professor Ernst Hassler. Professor Hassler and I worked together in the Berlin Neurological Institute before and during the last war.
Unfortunately, my political affiliations with the Third Reich were under investigation by the War Crimes Commission. However, Dr. Grimshaw managed to smuggle me into this country, where I masqueraded as a mental patient, in order that we might continue certain experiments which were interrupted by the American Army.
I can imagine the sort of experiments you conducted.
You and your friend Mr. K will discover their exact nature very shortly, Mr. Doherty. It is a magnificent opportunity to serve science.
I passed out. And the next thing I knew, I was coming to in a different room and hearing the voices of Voyna, Grimshaw, and Crakey. As if from a great distance.
The two-a-train. 4 cc's.
4 cc's.
How are the measurements?
Reducing rapidly.
We'll operate at once. Have Werner start the anesthesia.
Very well, Doctor. Come back.
Came to again, I had a blinding headache. I began to wonder if Crakey and Grimshaw weren't doing something to drive me insane, because I lost all sense of perspective. The room seemed to grow in size. I don't know how much time passed, but one day Crakey came into the room with a bundle in his arms about the size of a newborn baby. The bundle was my friend, Arthur Kay. And worse yet, I was exactly the same size that he was.
Let me out of here. Let me out.
Allow me to congratulate you, gentlemen. How are you feeling?
You dirty monster.
I'm disappointed, gentlemen. Do you not feel privileged to be a part of an experiment that will place me at the very top rank of the world's endocrinologists?
What are you doing to us, you madman?
It has long been established, gentlemen, that dwarfism and giantism result from injury to or malfunction of the pituitary and thyroid glands. The interlock between these glands was thought to be a hormone. I have discovered that this was incorrect. It was an enzyme. An enzyme I isolated some years ago. I was well on the way to synthesis in Germany when the surrender interrupted me. The interruption also limited the number and type of subjects on whom I could experiment. I was forced to find others.
Such as Harlan Ward?
Mr. Ward was only a control experiment.
I suppose you plan the same for us.
No, gentlemen. For you, I have reserved a special privilege. You, gentlemen, will be the first to test the full effects of the enzyme. In short, I intend that you, Mr. Kay, and you, Mr. Doherty, when the experiment is completed, will emerge as perfectly healthy, normal individuals. Except, of course, that you will be only 5 inches tall.
The days and nights that followed were a living nightmare. A nightmare from which Arthur and I awoke for brief periods to find ourselves in a strange new world. A huge, frightening world where everything seemed enlarged 100 times. When we finally emerged, we found ourselves imprisoned in a tiny mouse cage. Judging by the relative size of things, we could not have been more than 5 inches tall. Now we realized the experiment was at an end. That from now on, it was either escape or be destroyed.
How's it coming, Arthur? Another moment. I think I'll have this lock worked loose. And if we escape, then what?
We'll worry about that after we get out of this mouse cage.
Suppose we don't make it?
At least you've written the story on that scrap of paper. Someone may find it and read it.
Nobody will believe it.
Then why did you bother to write it?
I don't know. I suppose
I want the world to know what happened to me. That does it. Help me push the door open. Now what? The first job is getting down to the floor. I think we can make it by sliding down the telephone cord. Are you game? Go ahead. I'm right behind you. Easy now. Look out. That does it. Now, if we can figure out a way to get out of the room, that should be... Uh-oh. Listen. Somebody's coming. It must be Crakey. We've got to hide.
Here. The grate in the fireplace.
He'll kill us if he finds us.
Stay quiet.
Well, my friends, time for feeding. I trust that you... So, you have managed to break out. It won't do, you know. There is no way you could have gotten out of the room with the door and window locked. I know you are in here. I would advise you to save yourselves trouble and give up. Very well, my tiny friends. If you prefer to play the game of cat and mouse, then I shall be happy to furnish the cat. There is no way you can get out.
What now? He's gone for the cat. If that monster ever gets in here, we're goners. There must be... Wait a minute. What? Do you see that thin strand of wire running along the molding? What about it? It's the automatic fire alarm. When the alarm is tripped by a fire or short circuit, all the locks are sprung so that the patients can escape from their rooms. If I can short that wire before Crakey lets the cat into the building, let's go. There's a tiny sliver of steel from the cage on the floor. I'll work with that. You keep an ear to the door. Go ahead. This insulation is tough as rawhide. Life is stuck. Hurry up, Arthur, for God's sake. There it is. Stand away. I'm going to short it. Ready? Okay. We made it. There goes the door. Let's make a run for it down the hall. If we can get to the garden, we've got a chance.
I smell smoke.
The short may have actually started a fire. Come on. Wait a minute. I have to go back. The manuscript.
Don't be a fool. There's no time. Come on.
You go ahead. I'll catch up.
Hurry up. I'll wait in the hall.
Only a second. I've got it. Come on. There's nothing to stop us now. Arthur? Where are you? It's funny. Arthur? Arthur? Arthur, what's happened to you?
This is the record found in a fountain pen cover in the burned-out hallway of Dr. Grimshaw's sanitarium. There's nothing to add, except that the fire which destroyed the sanitarium and killed so many of its occupants, including Dr. Grimshaw and Dr. Voyna, was definitely of incendiary nature. It is believed by the fire chief that some small creature, possibly a mouse, chewed the insulation off the wire and short-circuited the system. The two patients, John Doherty and Arthur Kay, vanished completely after the fire, and their remains were never found. Whether the manuscript which you have just heard is authentic, or whether it was the work of one of the more demented inmates of the sanitarium, we leave to your judgment.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Street and Smith, publishers of astounding science fiction. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Fred Way and is an NBC Radio Network production. X-1.
Did you enjoy that one? I've been wanting to air this one for some time. There were some indications that all of the X-1 episodes were copyrighted. I have finally been able to establish that all of their works are under a Creative Commons license, which is good for us. Our story, Dr. Grimshaw's Sanitarium, first appeared in the May 1934 issue of Amazing Stories magazine. It was written by Fletcher Pratt. It was then adapted to radio for Dimension X on September 9th, 1950. X-1 repeated the episode, which is what we just heard, and is by far the best quality recording. X-1 got most of its stories from two of the most popular science fiction magazines of the time, Astounding and Galaxy. Ernest Canoy and George Lefferts adapted these stories and even wrote a few originals of their own. How about that? The date is September 2nd, 1945, and this is A Moment in Time. What you're about to hear is a rare recording that I found quite by accident. I was not looking for it. It found me. Douglas MacArthur was an American five-star general and field marshal of the Philippine Army. He was the chief of staff for the United States Army during the 1930s and played a prominent role in the Pacific Theater during World War II. He received the Medal of Honor for his service in the Philippines campaign, which made him and his father, Arthur MacArthur Jr., the first father and son to be awarded the medal. He was one of only five to rise to the rank of General of the Army, and the only one conferred the rank of Field Marshal. MacArthur is known for a speech in which he famously promised, "I shall return." That is not what we will hear today. However, after two more years of fighting in the Pacific, he did fulfill that promise. What we'll hear is from the fate-filled day in September when he officially accepted the surrender of Japan aboard the USS Missouri. Here is MacArthur himself and his speech titled, "The Holy Mission."
Today the guns are silent. A great tragedy has ended. A great victory has been won. The skies no longer rain death. The seas bear only commerce. Men everywhere walk upright in the sunlight. The entire world lies quietly at peace. The holy mission has been completed. And in reporting this to you, the people, I speak for the thousands of silent lips forever stilled among the jungles and the beaches, and in the deep waters of the Pacific, which mark the way. I speak for the unnamed brave millions homeward bound to take up the challenge of that future which they did so much to salvage from the brink of disaster. As I look back on the long, tortuous trail from those grim days of Bataan and Corregidor, when an entire world lived in fear, when democracy was on the defensive everywhere, when modern civilization trembled in the balance, I thank a merciful God that he has given us the faith, the courage, and the power from which to mold victory. We have known the bitterness of defeat and the exaltation of triumph, and from both we have learned there can be no turning back. We must go forward to preserve in peace what we won in war.
I hope you enjoyed that. It truly is a capsule in time. Unfortunately, that is not the entire speech. It went on for several minutes, speaking of the trials and tribulations of war, Japan's emergence, and even Filipino recovery. It was cut off, and I was not able to find the full copy. However, a transcription of his speech does exist, and I read for you now his final thoughts. "And so, my fellow countrymen, today I report to you that your sons and daughters have served you well and faithfully with the calm, deliberated, determined fighting spirit of the American soldier. Their spiritual strength and power has brought us through to victory. They are homeward bound. Take care of them." I will have a link to the entire speech in the show notes, and this has been A Moment in Time. On the podcast this time, I want to thank Darren McLeod, Jose Munoz, Shamir Donsuk, and Aaron Michaels for taking part in the show this time. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you'll find everything you need. We're on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and now on Radio Public. Please leave reviews or feedback on whatever service you use. It really helps us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.